Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, the state Supreme Court has okayed changes to who can file bar complaints against attorneys heading into the 2024 election. And we take a look at the history of zoos in Arizona and how they began as private menageries. But first this morning, we turn to our politics desk and an update on the so-called fake elector case that is back in court this week. For the last 2 days, attorneys for the defendants in the case have been arguing to Judge Bruce Cohn that Attorney General Chris May's past comments about the defendants prove the case was politically motivated and should be thrown out of court. This after a grand jury indicted the 16 defendants on charges of conspiracy, forgery, and fraud. Our own Wayne Shutsky has been in court reporting on it all week, and he joins us now in studio to talk more about it. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning.
All right. So in case anyone forgot, this case goes all the way back to the 2020 presidential election when these defendants got together to try to overturn the results of the election when President Joe Biden won. Now, the original 18 defendants is down to 16. Begin by just setting the scene for us here. Like, exactly where does this case stand right now?
As you mentioned, we're down to 16. We've had a guilty plea. We've had a charge dismissed against another candidate. And so now we're going through some of these preliminary early motions, as you mentioned. They're trying to get this case thrown out before we even reach a trial. And they're arguing, essentially, as you mentioned, that it was a politically motivated case that should be thrown out of court because there's no basis in actual legal arguments.
Okay. And this has to do with what's called an anti-SLAPP law. What's the argument?
So, yeah, anti-SLAPP law is basically laws that are supposed to provide individuals protection against baseless charges or baseless legal action that's politically motivated. Mm-hmm. You know, they're bringing this case against me because I'm a Republican, because I'm a Democrat, or because of my political speech, not because I actually broke the law, or even if I did break the law, that wasn't the reason they brought it. Mm-hmm. So that's what their argument is that Mays is bringing these charges against us because to violate our freedom of speech, our freedom to petition our government, our freedom to act politically in support of the politicians that we support.
Right. So what did they bring up in court to back up that case?
They pointed to past comments Mays made on the campaign trail, some tweets by her chief deputy, Dan Barr, that basically kind of indicated, you know, that said, I'm going to go after these fake electors even before she was in office. So they're saying that she didn't say I'm going to attack fraud or I'm going to attack forgery, which are some of the some of the charges in this case. They said, I'm going after these fake electors. They used the term fake electors, which the defense attorneys argued is a politically charged term. Mm-hmm. And so they kind of point to those comments saying she was roadmapping what she was going to do before she even got her hands on this case.
Okay. So this is a little unusual, right? Because the anti-SLAPP law in Arizona was bolstered just a couple of years ago by state legislators.
Yeah. So lots of states have anti-SLAPP laws, but they typically only apply to civil action. So like getting sued, like what we saw with Carrie Lake being sued by Maricopa County Recorder Stephen Richer over comments made about election administration. But Arizona expanded that law in 2022, as you mentioned, to cover criminal cases like the one we see before us. And there's been some comments made in court that they passed it specifically in anticipation of a case like this in the event that Arizona elected a Democratic attorney general who wanted to go after these Trump electors. And ended up being what happened.
But this is the first time this has ever been argued in court, these arguments then.
Yeah, there's been a lot of comments in court by attorneys that this is a novel situation because this is a newly expanded law. Arizona's kind of on the forefront on this more broad anti-SLAPP protection going all the way into criminal cases.
So this could very well set precedent going forward.
Yes. And the judge has, you know, he's made a lot of comments as he's hearing these arguments from both sides that, you know, he appreciates their legal rationale because he doesn't have a lot to rely on in terms of precedent. As you mentioned, he's just kind of got to take all these arguments in and see what he thinks really fits with what the law says.
Tell us more about the judge and how he seems to have received these arguments. Did he seem open to them?
He's taking a very measured approach. I would say he does seem open to them, but not in a sense that he thinks one side is making a better argument or the other. We haven't actually heard from the prosecution much yet. More that because this is such a novel situation he finds himself in. He doesn't want to give the impression that he's dismissing anyone out of hand. And so he's asking a lot of questions, sometimes pushing back on some of the things that these defense attorneys are arguing, but not in a way to indicate that he thinks they're wrong. Mm-hmm. He's saying, you know, when I go back and consider all of these arguments, I want to anticipate every question I might have pop up and have you answer them now so that I have all the information I need to make this decision.
Okay, so you mentioned we haven't heard in court, at least, a response from the prosecution on this. But what has Mays said? What has her office says about this? This did go through, we should say, a very extensive grand jury process before they were indicted.
Yeah, so her assistant attorney general, who's in charge of this case, did make a brief statement yesterday after court where he made that exact point. He said, you know, we will respond in court to all these accusations about political motivation, but I want to remind all of you that this did go through a grand jury. This wasn't a situation where the attorney general just filed a complaint and brought that to court. Mm. You know, we presented evidence to a grand jury, and the grand jury independently decided to bring these charges.
Yeah. Okay. So what is next year? We're watching for those arguments today.
Yeah. I'm about to head back to court. We have a few more hours there after a few long days, and we're going to see the prosecution respond to all of these allegations that this prosecution isn't based in legal fact, but that it's based in the desire to silence political speech.
All right. More to come on that then. KJZZ's Wayne Shutsky with our politics desk joining us. Heading back to court. Wayne, thank you.
Thank you.
Heading into the 2024 election, the Arizona Supreme Court has granted a request to change the rules about who can submit a bar complaint against an attorney in the state. Why? There was, quote, an explosion of complaints filed by people who had no direct connection to the underlying events. That is according to a top state court administrator who asked for the change. Jimmy Jenkins has the story for the Arizona Republic, and he joins us on the line now to tell us more. Thanks for coming on, Jimmy.
Good morning, Lauren. Happy to be here.
All right. So tell us, first of all, about who asked for this change and this, quote, explosion of complaints that motivated him to do it.
This was requested by Dave Byers, who is the director of the Administrative Office of the Courts. He submitted the rule change petition in response to what he told me was an explosion of complaints, like you said. He said that there were, by his count, 40 election-related cases were submitted from November 2020 to May of this year. And the way he sees it is that a lot of these cases are filed by people who don't have direct ties to the case. And he thought that this was problematic, could be kind of gumming up the works. And so this motion was meant to kind of curtail the number of people filing these bar complaints, as well as curtail and limit the amount of information that they have available to them.
Hmm. So does he think these were politically motivated, essentially?
He didn't go that far, but one of the people, attorney Diane Post, who I spoke with, who believes that she is one of the people who are kind of being targeted by this rule change, she does feel that in turn, I think that she is being maybe politically, gone after to stop filing these complaints. She and her colleagues have filed a lot of these election-related complaints against attorneys who they believe were acting inappropriately, who were involved in efforts to overturn the election. But her view is that, you know, this is, our, you know, attorneys are in the courtrooms, we're in the legal community, we know each other, it's our duty to kind of hold each other responsible. Responsible. So.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so tell us then how exactly these changes will affect things. Like, how did the process work before? How will it work now?
Before, you could file a bar complaint, even if you weren't directly related to a case, and you could attain standing as a complainant. And by doing so, as the investigation moved forward, you had access to lots of different kinds of information, you know, like the discovery process, things that come about in a normal lawsuit or complaint process. Now, if someone who is not directly involved in a case files a complaint, it will be reviewed by the state bar. They will make the decision based on different things, like did the allegations constitute serious misconduct, incapacity, overdraft of a trust account, or a criminal conviction. If they determine that the claims fall into one of those categories, then the bar itself will be the person who is substituted as the person filing the complaint, which would prevent the original person, like say a Diane Post, from accessing information obtained during the subsequent investigation.
Oh, and for now, these changes are just temporary, just until the election or around then, it sounds like?
That's right. Mr. Byers requested an emergency rule change so that it would take effect before the election. Post believes that this was done because the courts expect a slew of challenges, which, you know, she thinks that she and her colleagues would then file complaints about, because, you know, if they were deemed to be inappropriate. So it will be temporary, but it will take effect before the election. And then the state bar will vote on it again in a meeting that I believe that they're going to have this December. But the Chief Justice, Ann Timmer, has opened this process back up to public comment. So you can go on their website, check out the rule change. And if you feel strongly about it, you can add your two cents.
Let me ask you about the cases in which we've seen this happen, right, Jimmy? Like, we've seen the state bar investigate attorneys in connection with the 2020 election. In fact, the charges against some of those attorneys for Carrie Lake and Mark Fincham were just dismissed.
That's right. And one of the arguments from Diane Post, she told me that she believes the state bar has been derelict, quote, that was her word, in its duty to hold attorneys accountable. I reached out to the state bar for a response, but I haven't received one yet. You know, I think they would obviously say that they're doing their due diligence to keep an eye on their members. But yeah, Post is one of several people who are saying the state bar, we don't think, is doing enough on this on their own as far as launching investigations and as far as holding people accountable. And she actually went so far as to say, you know, by not holding people accountable for what happened in 2020, you're actually going to embolden people to do it more and more in subsequent elections like the one we have coming up.
What was the rationale for dismissing those charges we just mentioned?
You know, those are all posted online in the different investigations that you mentioned. But, you know, the state bar has decided that the people that the complaints were filed against did not meet, you know, the certain benchmarks like we talked about before for being held accountable, for being sanctioned.
Let me ask you about what Diane Post was asking for here. You mentioned, you know, some of her arguments. She's also calling for more transparency in this process. Is it a transparent process? Like, how much, especially with these changes, will the public be able to know?
Well, I would just say, as a reporter who has looked into this process, it is, we don't know a lot about the bar complaint process. You don't normally see a bar complaint unless you're looking for something specific. It's kind of hard to figure out, you know, where things are in the process or what the result was. And so attorneys like Post are saying, you know, we are citizen advocates out here. We are attorney advocates. We are, you know, keeping an eye on this process and watchdogging it and making it available to the public. So her argument was that a lot of the information that you could get through the investigation and discovery process is not even going to be available to them anymore, let alone the limited availability to information that the rest of us have.
Yeah. All right. We will leave it there for now. That is Jimmy Jenkins with the Arizona Republic joining us to talk more about this change and who can submit a bar complaint against attorneys in the state. Jimmy, thank you for taking the time to come on this morning. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Lauren. My pleasure.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a look at the history of zoos in Arizona and who brought the animals here.
People who were very wealthy and very connected and considered themselves often, they were both hunters and conservationists. So they had an interest that had to do with feeling an ownership of the land and of the animals on the land.
We'll hear how Arizona zoos showcased egos as much as animals. But first, last year, Mesa artist Erin Nimmer went to a conference in Utah, publicly declaring her support for LGBTQ people in her church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
I, in my life, have experienced loneliness. I've experienced like feeling like I don't belong. And I've experienced a lot of those things that I think LGBTQ people feel within the church. And so I think that when you go through things like that, your heart kind of naturally pours out to people who have experienced those types of things.
The LDS Church doesn't allow same-sex marriage. And while it says that identifying as gay, lesbian, or bisexual is not a sin, it also teaches that sex must remain between a man and a woman. But the church's position on LGBTQ issues has shifted over the years. In recent months, LDS leaders repealed rules that made same-sex marriage something you could be excommunicated for and allowed the children of gay parents to be baptized. Then, just last week, it put new restrictions on transgender members of the church. At the same time, there is a growing community of LGBTQ members of the LDS Church who are choosing to stay in it. They're meeting next month in Utah for their second Gather conference. Erin Nimmer went to the first last year.
You know, I have seen plenty of examples of people within the church, you know, gay people in the church who have been outspoken about their experience. And I think that that is huge. When people share their own experiences, it opens up your eyes and your mind to that. And you know, you want to be there for those people and you want to advocate for those people.
She's always been an artist and used it to express her own feelings of trauma and loneliness. So she brought one of her paintings to the conference. It features a suffering figure painted in blue, surrounded by brightness, with two angel-like beings comforting them.
When I went to this conference, you know, I had this piece of art, and to see people walk up to it and get tears in their eyes and point to that person who's struggling and say, "That's me." And I can resonate with that. And I want to hang this on my wall so I can be reminded that I'm not alone. That was the most meaningful thing to me. It's a part of that that I will always treasure.
One of the organizers of the Gather Conference is also one of the most outspoken voices about his own experience in the LDS Church as a gay man. Ben Chilati is a therapist as well as co-host of the podcast Questions from the Closet and author of the book A Walk in My Shoes, Questions I'm Often Asked as a Gay Latter-day Saint. In his therapy practice, he works primarily with LGBTQ members of the church. I spoke with him more about his work, his experience, and why he's felt compelled to share it.
Coming out is an interesting thing because it happens in these different processes and stages. So I first realized I was attracted to other guys when I was about 11, but that was not a problem. It was a phase. It was going to go away. And then I was a missionary for my church for 2 years when I turned 19. And then when I got home from my mission at 21, that was when I had to realize, well, maybe these feelings aren't going away. Maybe they're a part of me. And so I tried my very best to get married to a woman, do all the things, and not be a gay person. Mm-hmm. But then at 23, I was just spiraling and just super depressed and wondering how life could ever be happy. And I just super didn't want to be gay. And then I just had to tell someone. So I came out to my two best friends, and one of them was my roommate. And when I came out to them, I didn't use the word gay. That word scared me so much back then.
Yeah.
And I told both of them that I was more attracted to men than women. And then I turned to my roommate and I said, "You know, I understand if you don't want to be my roommate anymore."
Yeah.
And he said, "Why wouldn't I want to be your roommate? You're the same person you've always been." Hmm. And that was the beginning of my personal healing, where I could say, there's this thing that I hate about myself that I have judged myself for. And I'm sure you all will judge me for this. And for them to say, "No, we're not going to do that. We love you." Hmm. And so after that experience, when I was 23, I came out to other friends, my parents. And then 7 years later at 30, I just came out publicly on my blog.
Yeah.
And that just kind of skyrocketed me into this world that I hadn't been a part of being an openly gay Latter-day Saint and into this new community that I hadn't been a part of before.
So, I mean, what made you make that decision at 30 years old? Like, you had, it sounds like it's a long process, like almost a decade there of slowly talking to people in your life about this, but coming out publicly is very different. Why did you do that?
Yeah, you know, when I came out when I was 23, it was because I couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah.
Like, I would not survive any longer without letting people know. Like, I had to do it for me. When I was 30, I saw other people who were struggling and who felt alone. And I thought, well, maybe if I come out, then I can help other people and educate a community so that people don't have to suffer and struggle as much as I did.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about your decision to stay in the church, because I'm sure many people, if not most people in your position, would have left at a certain point. And I'm sure you know many who have. Why did you decide to stay and continue? Like, you wrote a book about this. You have a podcast. Like, you are an advocate in this way. Why was that important to you?
You know, the truth is that there have been many times I've seriously considered leaving. I love it. It's my home, but it's also caused me a lot of pain. And it's difficult to reconcile that something you love so much can also be hurtful and damaging. The time I was most close to leaving, I was 29. This was before I came out publicly. And I'd fallen in love with my best friend, who was also a gay member of the church. And and he was on his way out and wanted me to go with him. And that was appealing. But I wanted to stay and make it work in the church. And so I finally just knelt down and prayed and said like the most sincere prayer I've ever said in my life. And as I prayed, I just felt this strong divine presence inviting me to move forward within the teachings of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
So that means a lot for your personal life, right? Like, does it mean you have to be single, you can't date, or you would be excommunicated? How does it work theologically?
You know, theologically, what the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints teaches is that to reach the highest degree of heaven, you need to be in a marriage between a man and a woman. Mm-hmm. And there's no way around that. That is our theology and our teachings, and it's very clear. And so for someone like me, who has chosen to stay in the church, I either need to marry a woman, or I get something that's lesser than what married people get. And you know, I don't know how that's all going to work out. You know, I have my questions and concerns, but I also have a lot of faith and hope. So what that means for me now as an openly gay Latter-day Saint is I want to live the church's teachings on chastity, which is no sexual relations outside of marriage. And so I'm turning 40 soon. And up until this point in my life, I have never actively dated men. I just recently started dating guys. And I've talked to my local leaders and they're all fine with that, you know, as long as I keep the law of chastity, which I plan to do.
Okay, so I want to talk then about this community that you found and that I think you've very much helped build since you came out almost a decade ago, right? There's this Gather conference every year where this large community of LGBTQ people within the church come together. There are support groups like the one you started in Tucson that you mentioned. Tell us just the breadth of this that people might not know about.
Yeah. You know, we need to be with people who are like us, who have similar life experiences, who have similar beliefs and values that, you know, they're just people that you need to be with that you don't have to explain yourself to. Like, I don't have to tell you like what it's like to be me. You just get it. And that's what the Gather conference was all about, was let's bring together people who want to build their faith in Christ together and have Christ-centered support, but are also in this intersection of being LGBTQ and Latter-day Saints and their families and their friends and those who love them. It was like there was this palpable feeling of love, because for so many people, you know, I'm publicly out and I have many gay friends. Like, I could call my friend Charlie, who I do my podcast, you know, right now, and he would answer and I could talk about whatever I'm going through. Mm-hmm. Not everyone has that. And so the point of the Gather conference was there are people who are lonely, who are isolated, who are struggling, and they're feeling alone, and they don't have to be.
Yeah. What is the kind of official church reaction to this conference, to these communities, like to this openness about the fact that so many of these people live within the church and live openly within the church? Like, is it accepting?
Yeah. So the church made no statement about our conference. You know, we're not that big of a deal. But what the church's stance has been for a while and is that all are alike unto God. Everyone is welcome. Everyone is invited. Come and join with us. Hmm. And so the official church stance is if you want to come worship with us, come worship with us. We want you. We claim you. Not everyone follows that teaching. And some people are quite unkind, but I would say that's the minority, at least in my experience. You know, I haven't talked to any church leaders about this, but who wouldn't be thrilled that people are getting together to not only build their faith in Christ together, but to love and support one another.
You talked about the healing power that the conference and these gatherings can have for folks. But I mean, is it enough for people? Like, in a certain sense, do you see people leave a lot or say, I can't do this, or feel angry about the teachings?
There are a lot of people who are angry. And I have been angry at many times in my life. And one thing I always say in therapy is that anger is a secondary emotion. Mm. It usually hides deeper feelings like isolation or fear or shame. And as we work on those deeper feelings, the anger is often healed. And I think the thing I often felt the most was just betrayed. Like, I love this community and it's my home and I want to belong. And so when we're taught so explicitly that to belong looks like traditional marriage, and we feel like that's not possible for us, you know, for a lot of people it's like, well, there's just no place for me here. But there are many of us who are going to say, well, you know, we are going to make sure there's a place for us here. We have felt called by God to be here. And so yes, I would say most Latter-day Saints leave who are LGBTQ, but there are many of us who stay and many who left who never wanted to leave, who are seeking and yearning to come back. And we want there to be a place for them to come to.
All right. Ben, thank you so much for coming on the show and telling us your story. I really appreciate it.
Of course.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. There's been a gender gap in American politics for years, but an analysis from the Brookings Institution from earlier this year finds that gap is increasing among young voters between the ages of 18 and 29. The data show, in general, young women are becoming more Democratic in their political affiliation than young men. My co-host Mark Brody talked about why and what this could mean with Samara Klar, a political science professor at the University of Arizona. And they started with what she makes of these findings.
It seems as though a widening gender gap than what we have had in the past. You know, typically there's always a bit of a gender gap where women tend to support the Democratic Party at higher rates than men. Although I will say that that is usually concentrated mostly among non-white women who support the Democratic Party at really, really high rates. And so they really contribute to that gap. But that's getting even bigger now, where we're seeing larger gaps, especially in swing states, where women are supporting Kamala Harris at significantly higher rates. And whether men are getting more conservative is a little more tenuous. We're not seeing consistent evidence to suggest that that is the case. But women are absolutely becoming more liberal in their vote choices.
Yeah, I'm curious why that is. Like, why do we see the gender gap widening, as you say?
Well, you know, it's going to be a lot of speculation and people are trying to figure that out. But I think one pretty solid theory is the issues that are really salient right now do spark among women, primarily abortion and reproductive rights. We also have women who are voting for the first time. So, you know, young women or women who maybe are new to the United States or new recent citizens. And for them, they're forming their partisan attachments at a time when reproductive rights is very high on the agenda. So having that mobilize them can impact their party affiliation now and potentially for the rest of their lives.
So it sounds like what you're saying is, as with so many things in life, with political affiliation and this kind of thing, timing is everything.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, the party that you choose when you first start voting can be very influential over the course of your life. And that's why mobilizing young people is so important to both parties, because they feel as though if they can get them young, they can keep them for life. And to become a first-time voter when reproductive rights are all over the news, what people are thinking about, what is important to people, that's going to have a big impact on women in particular.
So is this to suggest that, for example, reproductive rights are not important to men generally? Are they not as important to men as maybe they are to women when it comes to who they're going to vote for?
You know, when we poll on reproductive rights, everyone says it's important. Republicans say it's important. Democrats say it's important. Men think it's important. Women think it's important. So we don't have a lot of people saying like, nah, this isn't really a real big issue for me. But what we see with voting choices, it seems like probably for women, it can be more mobilizing. Now, an important thing to keep in mind with abortion is that Democratic men are very pro-choice. I mean, at comparable levels to Democratic women. But when it comes to the importance of the issue, it looks as though it is probably driving women's votes at higher rates.
So it sounds like maybe it is an important issue, but maybe not the most, or maybe not the top type of issue that will lead a particular voter, in this case, a male voter, to pick a candidate.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's funny because when we ask people, you know, is this issue important? Is immigration important? Is the economy important? It's all important. And everyone's going to say, yes, that's important. This is important. This is important. So it's kind of hard to parse that out from survey data because it's unusual for someone to say an issue is unimportant, especially when there are so many important issues that impact us. But kind of put, you know, when it comes down to actually showing up at the polls, actually supporting a candidate, that's where it looks as though women are supporting pro-choice candidates at higher rates than men. And that is largely, I would suggest, is largely driving this growing gender gap.
Okay. Are there other like non-political ramifications here in terms of men and women seeing things differently?
You know, it's hard to say. There is a lot of data out there suggesting that marriages are more politically homogenous than they once were. So, for example, men and women agree within their marriage on politics more than they used to. And that's using data going back, you know, several decades. There's a lot of reasons for that. Potentially one reason is that women in the 40s, 50s, and 60s were not as outwardly involved in politics on average. And now women are voting at equal or higher rates than men. Now, if women become more democratic than men, then you know, potentially we'll see a little more diversity in relationships, or, you know, people might start to switch. They start to persuade each other, and maybe we'll see a little more intramarriage persuasion going on.
Right. So what kind of impact do you think it has on this gender gap that one of the major party candidates is now a woman?
Well, we very rarely will find, you know, Republicans or Democrats switching their party vote in order to support a woman. In fact, I've actually done some research showing that Republican and Democratic women have very different ideas of what it even means to be a woman. So for Republicans, seeing a Democratic woman doesn't necessarily persuade them. And the same can be said for Democratic women. We rarely, if ever, will find a Democratic woman saying, you know what, I'm going to vote for the Republicans this year because they have a woman candidate. But for people voting for the first time, for young women voting for the first time, be very important. Seeing that kind of a representation may increase Democratic affiliation among first-time voters.
You kind of alluded to this, but I want to ask more specifically how racial differences kind of play into the gender gap and how, you know, different ethnic groups might be at play in here as well.
Sure. Well, you know, for many years, scholars found that there is a big gender gap where women are supporting Democrats at much higher rates than men are. But people then started to notice that's actually largely attributed to non-white women. In fact, white women do support Republican candidates at higher rates than Democrats. Now, they don't support Republicans at the same rate than men. But until, I believe, Donald Trump and Joe Biden's election, women were voting for Republicans more often than they were voting for Democrats, white women, I should say. So non-white women play a huge role in this gender gap because it is really non-white women who are supporting the Democrats at the highest rates.
I guess a lot of this kind of brings the question, and I wonder if we're kind of making a mistake if we think of women voters as a monolith, like women
vote
this way. Like, that seems like it's not the case.
I hesitate to think of, honestly, any group as a monolith because
there's
so much political diversity within these groups. And that's exactly right. I mean, the identity of being a woman, I mean, first of all, that constitutes half of the population. Roughly half the population. It's an incredibly politically diverse group. There are Republican women are pro-life, just like Republican men. And partisanship is much more determinative of vote choice than gender. So when we talk about women, yes, we need to think of the intersection of many other identities, including, and especially, I would say, race and ethnicity.
Again, you kind of alluded to this, but I want to ask a little bit more in depth. You mentioned how women are becoming more liberal, many women in any way. Are we seeing that men are they kind of staying where they are and just not becoming as liberal as quickly as this group of women? Are they actually going the other direction and leaning more to the right? Do we know this?
You know, that's a question that I don't think we have consistent evidence to answer. I would say on average, men are looking pretty stable in their vote choice. I have seen some surveys suggesting that younger men may be trending more conservative, but I don't see enough consistent evidence to say that authoritatively. Generally, this gap is driven much more by women than it is by men. It's women pulling away to the left and men more or less staying status quo.
All right. That is Samara Klar, a political science professor at the University of Arizona. Samara, nice as always to talk to you. Thank you.
You as well. Talk again soon.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. If you've ever visited the Phoenix Zoo or the Reed Park Zoo in Tucson, you probably spent most of your time focused on the animals. But the idea of the city zoo as a scientific educational institution is a relatively recent phenomenon. For this summer's edition of the Journal of Arizona History, researcher Courtney Lamb wrote about the early days of zoos, when they were more like roadside attractions. As Lamb told the show's Sam Dingman, for a long time, zoos were a place to display not only animals, but also the egos of the eccentric men who owned them.
They were very much created by people who were very wealthy and very connected and considered themselves, often they were both hunters and conservationists. So they had an interest that had to do with feeling an ownership of the land and of the animals on the land, and therefore for some of them also feeling a responsibility towards making sure that those animals were propagated. And zoos were a way to do that, and also to show off power and that you had access to the these animals and that you could transport them. So that, you know, played on a long, centuries-long tradition of menageries and wealthy, you know, monarchs having menageries of their own.
Well, a couple of those interesting characters, one is Frank Murphy. I found a very interesting news item from him in the 1912 tombstone epitaph that basically talks about his menagerie, to use your word, Courtney, and how remarkable it seemed back in 1912. It says here that he has two mountain lions, two wild cats, a badger, two civet cats, three foxes, two black-tailed deer, a black eagle, a raven, a guinea pig, and four monkeys.
Yeah, quite a collection, quite a random collection. He was a Prescott Railroad baron, and so he started this private zoo. And yeah, there were very much these characters who just sort of decided that attaching yourself, especially to exotic animals, was desirable, and it indicated something positive about you.
It's kind of interesting to think about this being a period where if you were going to be the proprietor of the zoo, you had to own the land, you had to have the collection, and then you also had to have the know-how to care for these animals. Our producer actually flagged another really interesting piece about another figure in this curious history, Harry, quote, Indian Miller, who we should say was not indigenous, but that's a nickname that he apparently went by. This very interesting item in the Winslow Mail from 1925 about how he encounters this guy who says he has two eagles to sell, and Miller buys the eagles from him, but then realizes they can't fly. So he ends up just taking care of them and teaching them how to fly, and they end up becoming fixtures at his personal zoo.
Yeah, I'll tell you, you're talking to the right person, because my master's thesis was actually about Harry Indian Miller, who did spend...
Okay.
Yeah, who spent two decades pretending to be an Apache Indian, which he was absolutely not. And he would regularly get mauled by these animals because he handled them a lot. Because this idea of, so what if you're not a rich person? You're showing off that you have a connection to the animals by handling them a lot.
Yeah. So tell us how do we get from this period of time where the zoo is more associated with this kind of individual eccentric figure and into a time when it becomes kind of a major anchor institution of a city?
The professionalization of zoos really, in America especially, really took off and really was formulated in the 70s because of these pressures, animal rights and animal liberation movements. A lot of very legitimate questions that the zoos didn't necessarily have great answers for, because they had been doing something that was very established for a very long time, and their expertise was dialed into doing it that way. So making that shift took a while, and it was contentious. It was really batten down the hatches in a lot of ways, of not wanting to engage with the critics too much, or of pushing aside the criticism. But meanwhile, they were in fact professionalizing the whole thing. You couldn't just show up. You know, it changed in the era of the 70s, 80s, and 90s. You couldn't just show up and say, "I'd love to be a zookeeper." I mean, we see this in this Reed Park Zoo. It was just a parks and rec guy being like, you know, let's have some animals, you know, and then he just kind of made it happen. Whether that's good or bad, it's not the question. He was able to do that. And then so moving past that to where you needed a degree, and there were apprenticeships, and there were people with expertise in biology and zoology, was, I think, a response to all of this, these questions of, we can't just be amusement parks with living collections.
Right. But what about the transition from, I mean, the Reed Park Zoo is a 501c3 nonprofit, same for the Phoenix Zoo. That's very different than, you know, the private menagerie of an eccentric collector who's charging you money when you're driving along Route 66. That must have been a pretty significant transition, too, to shift public perception of these things from the realm of private ownership to a kind of public resource. How did that happen?
So if you read the history of zoos in America, some people have said, look, there was, they've positioned it as, yes, there was a change in messaging at this time because of these pressures of the environmental movement and species mm-hmm. extinction and so on, but that the actual practices of how the animals are kept, which animals are kept, how big are the collections, how diverse, you know, how many types of animals are there, that the practices weren't that different. Mm-hmm. And it took a while for the practices to catch up to the messaging. But we also had, as a response to all that in the 80s, especially in Arizona, an era of sanctuaries. That became the mm-hmm. new idea that you would have. So, for instance, the Keepers of the Wild Nature Park is somebody who had worked in Vegas, you know, for animals that had been used in acts there. You know, that's a different kind of positioning of what this facility is. But ultimately, you go, it's animals in cages or enclosures. You know, it's sort right. of the same, but the right. thinking behind it, the intention behind, that's what we see again and again in zoo history. What is the intention behind it? And then physically, what is it like when you're there? Well, the physical part tends to be very recognizable throughout history.
Yeah. Zoo layout is sort of applying human organizational philosophy to the natural world. I think you were alluding earlier, Courtney, to the fact that the philosophy behind the layout and messaging of zoos has really started to evolve. So tell us about some of the more avant-garde or cutting-edge ways of organizing zoos that are shifting that.
Multi-species enclosures. That's a big change that I'm seeing more and more, that there's an understanding that you get so used to seeing them sort of isolated in small groups, you know, mm-hmm. with a label next to them. And it can be quite thrilling and shocking to see a huge herd running across the desert sands, to mm-hmm. see them in their habitat like that. And I think that is something maybe more zoos are trying to pull in to help right. us understand what the stakes are. But also, it's a different way. We haven't been encouraged to think of ecosystems this way for a long, long time. So if mm-hmm. we are being steered towards that by zoos, I think that can only be a positive thing.
Yeah. Well, Courtney Lamb is a PhD student at UC Riverside, and she wrote about the history of zoos for the Journal of Arizona History.
All right, that'll do it for this Wednesday edition of the show. Be sure to join us tomorrow. We'll have much more as always. And also, don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. And if you heard a song you liked on today's show, you can follow us on Spotify as well. Just search KJZZ's The Show on the app, and you will find our monthly playlist of every song you're hearing. The show was produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, Ayanna Hamilton, and reporter Sam Dingman, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor. Chad Snow is our news director. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know your story ideas, what's happening around your community. We are at the show at kjzz.org. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.